Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we're excited to chat with internationally renowned wild foods expert, author, and public speaker, Miles Irving. Miles has worked with some of the world's best chefs and has been a pioneer in the wild food renaissance. In 2009, he authored The Forager Handbook, hailed by many as a foraging Bible. Through communicating with people around the world and delving deep into the environmental and emotional issues facing us, he has sought to bring together traditional ecological knowledge and those hungry for land-based connection, community, and culture, reconnecting with the life-giving wild land which has long sustained us is key. This represents not only a way forward, but a wildly different way of looking at the world. Miles, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour.
You're very welcome.
It's a pleasure to have you on. I know you have a podcast of your own. You're a consultant, educator, wild food expert. So there's a lot to talk about. But you know, before we jump into all the topics, I always need to know how you got into this world. You know, maybe how you discovered or how you developed your relationship with natural systems, traditional ecological knowledge, foraging. That's a story of many podcasts, but you know, the overviews and highlights got you to where you are today.
So I think the first real influence was probably my dad. We lived in inner city Birmingham, but my dad used to work at the university. He did a night shift there. And so he'd have to walk a long way back at night, and he'd encounter kind of, you know, wildlife. And despite the fact it's the city, he would see foxes and hedgehogs and things like that. And he would always just communicate such a sense of delight and wonder about these things when he told us about it. Yeah, and he would just simple things, which is not so unusual, but little things like bringing frog spawn home and watching the tadpoles develop into frogs and things like that. But I think, yeah, it was that sheer delight and wonder that my dad had in encountering wildlife and so on. So that primed me. Then we moved out of the city, and for a while we were living with my grandparents in a place called Suffolk, East Anglia, just north of London. And my granddad had a little bit of land. He had a little bit of woodland and some sort of meadowland. The second or third day we were there, just before I started school, because it was the summer holidays, he took me out mushroom picking. That was an absolutely life-changing experience. So we walked out the front door, and we could see across this meadow, and there was two or three parasol mushrooms, like maybe, I don't know, about 150 meters away. And it caught my eye immediately. So I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, let's go and see." So he wouldn't tell me what it was. But they looked like dinner plates floating in the air. You know, it's intriguing. I didn't know they were mushrooms, but they caught my eye. And so we walked across, and he said, "Well, there you go. You see, they're mushrooms. And as a matter of fact, they're one of the ones we can pick and eat. So we will pick them and take them back and cook them." And then we went into the woodlands, and to the best of my memory, we found two other mushrooms. It's possible we found others, but what I can recall is we found an aniseed clitocybe, which, if you know that, it's a very dramatic looking. It's kind of like a bluish green, sort of aqua blue color, so quite eye catching in that sense. But it has this fantastic aniseed aroma, yeah. Which I was completely enchanted by this. And then the other one was a wood blur. So again, a very dramatic, brightly
beautiful
colored
mushroom,
beautiful,
yeah.
Mushroom, and with this beautiful sort of mealy smell. So yeah, I was already hooked simply by the experience of going out and finding these things. But the icing on the cake was we took them back and cooked them and just ate them with an English breakfast, some bacon and eggs, potatoes, and these cooked mushrooms. So that was the clincher. So not just the fact of we found something, it's amazing, but it's also delicious. And I had just this basic idea switched on in my mind that there's this treasure hunt that you can do out there. There's things you can find which are edible, delicious, amazing, fascinating, and actually they're just there. It's just that if you know about it, you can join in this treasure hunt. If you don't, you're just going to walk on by and be completely ignorant. So that was it. I was very lucky to have that experience. Now, it's not that my grandfather had some kind of deep roots and all this sort of thing. Not at all. He works, you know, he was a civil servant. He worked for the Ministry of, I think it was the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Food or something like that at the time. But that was enough for him to have an interest in slightly different approaches to food. So he'd bought himself a book on edible wild mushrooms, and he'd learned a handful of species. That's all he ever learned, was just a handful of species, but enough to turn his six-year-old grandson onto it and start a lifelong, you know, enthusiasm and engagement in it. So yeah, that's how I got started.
You know, and I know sometimes it's hard to pick out one seminal moment for people, and that your relationship with nature is such a massive concept. But man, that sounds really central to talking about charting the course of the rest of your life. And, you know, that's the beautiful thing about foraging, is no matter your background, I mean, it appeals to your belly, your aesthetics, that treasure hunt aspect. People from all different backgrounds and levels of kind of appreciation of nature can be connected with this activity, and that kind of leads to more and more. Now, for you, what kind of brought things further? Because obviously you ended up exploring concepts of traditional ecological knowledge, really understanding ecosystems. So I think for you, what or was there something that you think drove you to go further and kind of connect with some of these bigger concepts that you educate about?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just thinking, because like that was the door opener. And so I carried on mushroom foraging. I've always done that. But like when I was just slightly older, sort of 8, 9, 10, that sort of thing, I was really into watching birds. And so I spent most of my spare time just out in fields and things like that, and woods, just exploring out on my bike and sitting still and, you know, doing things that I guess most kids don't do.
Right. I was about to ask if a lot of kids were doing that in that time.
No, but you know, I tell this story. Well, first of all, the farmer's son, who is a bit older than me, he was also a very keen bird watcher. So that was good. I had like a peer, you know, but on the whole, like the kids at school thought it was pretty weird that's what I did. But, you know, you're a kid. So these other kids would still come out and wander around in the woods, right? They wouldn't be seeing this aspect of being in the woods. They just think, well, we're going to climb trees and muck around and throw stones and whatever. But one day I'm with this friend of mine, and there was a little bird. It's called a goldcrest. I don't know if you have them where you are, but it's just stunningly beautiful, sort of olive green on the back, and then a little eye stripe that's yellow. And then the male one has a little eye stripe that's red, and it's tiny. It's Britain's smallest bird. So to see it is pretty magical. And we saw it within like 2 meters away on a holly bush. And I just said to my mate, I just grabbed a stick and went, shh, shh. And we just stood there and watched it. And we probably stood there for 6 or 7 minutes. And, you know, he's never done anything like, you know, what are we doing? He's like, why is Mars making me stand here and be quiet? And he talked to me about that a couple of days later. He said, you know, when we stood in the woods and watched that bird in a bush. I said, yeah. He said, I feel really embarrassed about that. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, it's kind of soft, isn't it? Or I forget the words he used exactly, but like he just felt like maybe it wasn't a very masculine thing to do, or
oh, no.
I don't know what it was, but he said he felt embarrassed. I said, well, that'd be stupid. You know, it was amazing. Like, you don't often get an opportunity like that to see a bird like that so close up. I don't know what you're worrying about. Anyway, the point of telling this story is that I didn't really stay that in touch with this guy. It's one of those things with old school friends, but occasionally you bump into each other and then you know, you go and have a drink or whatever. Like, and so like probably 30, I should say a good 30 years later, I spent some time with this guy, and he said, you know what, at the weekends, because his job involves having a big van, he said, I throw a mattress into the back of the van, I just drive into the forest and sleep there, you know. And I went on his Facebook page a little while ago, and he's all got like pictures of spiders and things like that he's seen, and photographs. So, you know, he's deeply engaged with the natural world. So I think that moment for him, he didn't actually say that to me, but my guess is that moment, which he found embarrassing, was a turning point. And there is actually some research on this. People are saying now that for most people that really find that nature connection, if they trace it back, they will find an encounter with usually one species. There's a moment when they make something happens, and their heart opens, and they have this emotional sense of connection, that'll do it. You're in now. It's like an induction or initiation. Right. You know, you catch that here's this other being, and here am I. Here's and there's a so something happens, and that door that opens the door. Now you are part. Now you're part of this. Up to then, you're walking around with blinkers on. You know, but of course, the terrible thing is that for so many people, they've not. You know, they're 38, they're 59, they're whatever, and they're still waiting for that moment. You just think, wow. What can happen to get that on? So,
Well, and the other part of that dynamic is observation. That's one quality that always strikes me about people like yourself, people who are kind of foraging leaders and educators. There's often unique qualities of observation people have that lead them. Maybe that's what you need. I mean, that's a chicken and the egg scenario. Maybe that's what you need to then have that connection is you need to tap into your own powers of observation for long enough to where you can suddenly realize there are other organisms there and then develop that connection.
Well, I suppose it's applying the powers of observation because people are using them. Like if you know, if someone's spending all day on a computer game, they're not going to go up a level unless they're using, you know, but right. The culture that we're in, there's no necessity. And of course we'd all have that encounter if we were back in a situation where all the things that we need, we're only going to obtain them based on a relationship with the species in our environment. So there's just no way. You can't spend a morning, let alone a week, let alone a year, let alone half your life, not observing the living things around you, because that's what you got to do in order to survive. And so it's, we've come a long way, and now there just aren't, it's just that. We can still observe. We're not applying it, though, to the living things around us.
Well, to throw out a massive question that, you know, is the talk of philosophers and people for years and years and years, but to throw out a big concept, how do you think we instill some of that into our culture? I mean, you know, is this something that parents can instill in their children like your family did for you? Or how do you see that kind of relationship with nature really that comes as a result of spending more time in it? How do we suffuse that into a culture that seemingly doesn't need to engage with nature for our day-to-day life?
Well, so it's a culture of around the foraging to get that started. So the teaching that I'm doing now is really targeted at switching people on to the species that are most likely to grow near their house. Mm. So it's quite funny. People rock up. Well, I do warn them in advance, but I'm sure when they book the course, they're not expecting that all we're going to do. We're welcoming into the room I'm in now, actually, and I'll show them a bunch of plants laid out on a table with labels on, right? There's between 8 and 15, it varies, you know. And they all take photographs of those plants, and all they're going to do is go out of the door that's just next to me and walk around the building and come back in again. We're not going to the forest, we're not going right. to the mountains, and we're not going to the beach, because I'm not going to help you very much if I show you what grows there, unless you happen to grow near the beach. And I find that not everybody, you know, but everybody does live in a house that has grass somewhere nearby. Everybody does live in a house with a few very common trees or bushes nearby, or they have some disturbed ground. So we look at these 10 or 15 species, which I can pretty much guarantee they're at least going to find 70% of those within 200 yards of their house, wherever they live. Even if it's in the middle of London, these are plants that are everywhere. That's what I'm kind of really focused on, giving people the best possible chance of creating a connection between the plants that actually grow near where they live. And it's amazing once you've got people to. So, but here's the other part of what I do. Actually, it's so I've found out for years. Like you've introduced me as a wild food expert. I actually bristle when I hear that word expert now, because I think it's half the problem. You see, all I am is a normal person. Yeah, I'm a really, really normal person. The thing is, everybody else is a bit odd because they're living for 20, 30, 60 years, as we've already discussed, without actually knowing what the other living things that are in their environment are. And that's really fucking weird, actually. To be an organism, right, that doesn't have any idea what the other organisms are in your surroundings, that's strange. Right. So I'm a normal person. I'm not an expert. I'm a normal person. I'm getting normal. I'm a recovering weirdo, you know, like I used to be weird and didn't know any of these plants. Now I know some and I'm getting to know them better. Yeah. So I am just trying to help other people become normal.
I love that perspective, and talk about making it approachable. Is Miles Irving is not on a pedestal as the expert. He's just a recovering weirdo. And we can all be recovering weirdos then.
That's right. Anyway, so the thing I say to people, like we've just said about the observation thing being a faculty with this, it's intact, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with our powers of observation, right? It's just right. What we're applying them to, you know. And I mean, you know, I defy you to put a 50-pound note on the floor and see if people are going to see that, you know, right? But what I say to people is what we're going to do is switch on your pattern recognition capacity as it applies to wild plants in your surroundings. Because at the moment, for most of you, it's entirely switched off. Well, it might be switched on for one or two species. But the thing is, it's definitely not broken. We just need to activate that. And sure enough, so what I'm trying to do is move away from the disempowerment of expertise. Yeah. And I'm not going to stand there showing people the plants saying, this is this one, isn't it? I do that with my display. I've got a display of the 10 or 15 plants with a label. So I explain the plants to everybody. But we hand them around, they're looking at them, then they photograph them. Then I say, right, off you go. You go and find these 15 plants. I'm staying here. See you in a bit. And they go out and find the 15 plants. And it's just very rarely they come back and say, we couldn't find this one. So I then edge them in the right direction and go kind of warmer, 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 you know, and I help them out. But apart from anything else, it's peer-to-peer learning, because some of them will find them and help the others to find them. But actually, I will say this is experimental. I've done this for about 4 months now. So I've now got to follow this up and do a bit of research, you know, send some questionnaires to everybody. But then I've got to send the same questionnaires to the people that did the courses before that and see. But I'm pretty certain that what we're going to have is people who have actually learned the plants, because they're not passively standing there while I tell them how much I know, you know. And what people say is, like, we then go out for a walk. We do go out for a walk, but people are then saying, well, I'm seeing it everywhere now. You're right. The pattern recognition thing is switched on. Now I'm seeing yarrow everywhere. And they go, oh, there's a whole way to get. Oh, look, there's, you know. And it is just so easy, you know, because yeah. Of course, this, like I say, this is completely normal. For organisms to be just scanning, they're just orienting in their surroundings, saying, what's here? Of course you do that. But we've been infantilized because we're just like a baby. That mother just brings us, you know, mother is the industrial food system, unfortunately. Right. It's just bringing us everything that we need. So we never have to kind of move. So those, it's like we're like 30-year-old babies or 50-year-old babies or whatever. Whereas, you know, for some things, like developmentally, if you don't learn to talk by a certain age, you are actually buggered for the rest of your life. It's very hard to switch some of these things on later on when children are neglected and don't have social contact, for example. But in this case, it's not at all. You can switch it on in a day. You know, you can get this stuff working and have normal humans wandering around actually eating things that grow in the place that they live. Immediately.
I love how you've framed all this, because I mean, you've made it eminently approachable. It is an empowering method, and I love that your teaching style, you're getting at some fundamental roots of allowing people to kind of become more, I don't know the best word for it, maybe well-rounded human beings. Is yes, yeah. You already have your powers of observation, you already have your pattern recognition. There's that age-old, I mean, cliche at this point, but you show kids 100 trees or 100 logos, and they know what all the logos are, and they know what none of the trees are. So clearly, yeah. All those capacities are still functioning. You're just figuring out ways to migrate those to the natural world like a normal person.
Yeah, like a normal person. Got it.
Well, I love how that's evolved for you, and I think that's a really exciting way to engage in foraging. That's always one of my questions, too, is for someone who, we're not going to say expert, is a normal human, how did you achieve that knowledge? I mean, was your path much like that, where you kind of saw forms, just engage your own powers of observation? I mean, I'm sure there are mentors and resources along the way, but how did this knowledge really start to accumulate for you, if there are certain tools or people involved that others may be able to learn from too?
Well, I think my major tool was obsession.
Obsession. That's a great trait to have on your side.
Yeah. It just, there was a time when To be honest, writing my book was it sort of peaked in the time I was writing my book, because, you know, I was initially asked to write a book and we said, oh, we'll have 30 species in there, and it was going to be the stuff that I knew best. And I thought, well, what's the point of that? Like, you know, if I'm writing a book, we might as well actually try and push the boat out and get a lot more species into the foraging repertoire, you know, because there's more than 30 species. And none of the books that were out there were even attempted to be comprehensive, you know. So I was just trawling through the botanical atlas of the British Isles and going through all the plant families. And, you know, it was just, I just got completely immersed in it. And my wife says she was a book widow for 3 years.
She lost you to the book.
But the point is, the book was you know, this was about whenever we go out, I'm constantly looking at stuff, you know. It got to the point, right, we watched a film, and I think it was like a Western or something like that. But the thing is, this is in a rural location. And I'm seeing plants. Oh, God, we've got to stop this. Like, what is that plant?
You broke the immersion, Miles.
And there was a point at which we had to, if we were going to go out and not talk about plants or not have me do this, we'd have to go, you know, into the city at night, you know, so that I couldn't even look at the little planters that might have some weeds. And I'd be, you know, I was just having so much fun just thinking I'm really, really going to learn these plants and these plant families. And but I guess in terms of mentors, not really foraging wise, but plant wise, I reached out to a very large number of botanists when I was trying to get this kind of like, okay, let's see. And we know when they achieved it. I've got about 300 plant entries, and with the extra ones where we say similar species and so on, There's probably one for every day of the year, roughly 365 plants in my book. And since then, you know, I've learned a few, but you know, we were very skimping on the grasses, and we could have had a lot more grasses in there. And some of the plant families, we ended up just not being comprehensive. So I would say 800 we could have had, but I was trying to really just get at least these 365 on the map to say, well, these are at least our basics, you know. And the literature up to then, no one had tried to do it. They were just, you know, going for the obvious ones. I had all of these botanists that I reached out to sort of check my stuff, you know, am I saying anything stupid or wrong? But I managed to hit a couple of jackpots there because I found a couple of really eminent botanists who are really into foraging or really into ethnobotany or, but you know, plant use generally, who've become friends. So in that sense, like from a botanical point of view, I had some mentors. Yeah. But the foraging thing, and then the other side, other mentors would have been chefs, you know. So I'm learning about food, I'm learning about cooking, and these guys are taking the plants. There's a guy called Peter Whedon in particular, he was our favorite customer. We heard about him. We heard there's this chef that's using loads of wild stuff. And when we eventually made contact, he said something. It wasn't quite this, but he along the lines of said, where have you guys been all my life? Because he was trying to be a chef, full-time chef, do all this foraging, you know, and he couldn't forage enough. So this was a guy that would be ordering like 20 kilos of wild plants from us a week, whilst at the same time picking 20 kilos of wild plants himself a week, in his spare time. So there were some guys like that that were just, they were just lost in this great adventure of cooking with wild plants. I have to say, to a large extent, it's not been like that really with a lot of the chefs. It was kind of tokenistic and a bit like you got to do some wild stuff to be trendy. But there were a few of these guys who were just, it was just magical working with them, because they, you know, they're discovering new plants, new flavors, new textures, new techniques, you know, or applying techniques that you'd use across the board to cooking vegetables, but saying, well, we'll try treating hogweed like celery, or and coming up with these fantastic ways of cooking, which I still use to this day. Yeah, so that was kind of mentorish, I guess.
Well, when you find someone who shares your obsession, that can be a magical moment.
Exactly. So yeah, but really, you know, there was, you know, it was quite an adventure, that whole thing with working with the chefs and the restaurants. But
I was curious how that business evolved for you. I'm always curious about that transition as someone who's obsessed with the natural world, and clearly you had the obsession just to learn it all.
Yeah.
And then how that channels into kind of a business or an industry, because sometimes it doesn't always align.
Well, yeah, and I know we've had lots of kind of wrangling really with concerned individuals who kind of feel that the whole idea that you can take something wild and then sell it and so on is just really offensive and difficult. And
right.
I mean, in itself, yeah, offended for that reason, at the whole idea of commercial foraging. It's wild and free, it shouldn't be sold and so on. And then on the other hand, people who mistakenly think that harvesting wild plants is damaging. I mean, I kind of hear people who have really engaged with indigenous cultures and they're talking about, you know, reverence and respect for the plants and things like that. All of a sudden, if that's what people were saying, I would understand it. But it isn't. It's generally a kind of display of ignorance, because if you know anything about how these life cycles work, if you know anything about ecology, if you know anything about evolution, life is sustained because living things eat other living things. And the fact that you get everything from your supermarket, which has come from a factory, which has come from an industrial food system. So yeah, you don't have to think ever like that.
Right.
You don't think about it, but actually, there's a massive impact to every time you open your mouth and put something in it. But for some reason, people can't make the jump from, okay, so it's like, you know, if we harvest these wild plants, we're having an impact now on ecology. And like, okay, so what you had for dinner, that came from Mars, presumably.
Right.
No impact on the planet then, you know, like,
right.
It's just like, you can't be a living thing that eats something without there being something that's happening in relation to the ecology of your planet on which you happen to live. You just can't do it. If you don't like that, I'm afraid you're going to have to starve, because, you know, there is a footprint. But the point is, you know, species that have an ecological niche, that footprint is benign.
Yeah.
So it's not hands by your side, don't touch anything, don't create any disturbance. So there's this idea people are overworked with a sort of what we call the fortress conservation mindset, which is that, like, oh, leave it alone, don't touch it. You know, you're a human, you'll only ruin it. You know, just get out of the way and let the nature do its thing, you know. But actually, the whole point about ecological niches is that, you know, the beaver, the badger, the bee, you know, they all create disturbance of some kind. In other words, it's different because they're there to what it would be if they weren't there, and that's called disturbance. You know, the fact that in some cases it's blindingly obvious that this is enhancing the ecology, but, you know, like pigs go wild boar, they go in and they just tear up the forest floor, tear it up. Oh dear, wild pigs, you know, dear, well, you know, we better ban wild pigs then.
Right.
But they're a huge part of the evolution of forest landscapes and so on. So the point is, We've come up against quite a lot of antipathy for both of those reasons. The idea that, like, if it's commercial, this is capitalism, this is, you know, this is against the grain for this thinking that we're trying to apply to make the world a better place and pull down the neoliberal capitalist consumer industrial machine. The thing is, I'm all for pulling down the neoliberal capitalist consumer regime, you know. But you know, the basic starting point of making a living from foraging, we just thought, well, what are you talking about? You know, this is amazing. Like, clothes that were paid for with money made by gathering wild plants. I mean, you know, my house is roof over my head. You know, I feel very proud of that. I don't have money coming from anywhere else. It's all from foraging. And, you know, I love it.
And wild foraging to me is subversive to that neoliberal commercialist type of culture that we live in. I mean, there's so much about mushroom foraging, wild plant foraging that is directly subversive. So if you're picking out someone who's selling that as being kind of antithetical to this puritanical belief system that you hold, well, you need to really start applying that to a lot bigger issues. And then eventually, if the biggest problem we have is Miles picking plants and selling it to people that want them, that'll be an amazing world. I'm all for that. But until that point, this is actually one of the few ways for me, as someone who, you know, is maybe politically subversive, I don't want to support the systems of control that run in our societies in a lot of ways. Everyone's wrestling with that. And to think that you can go out into the natural world, commune with organisms that, like you just explained, a lot of times are adapted to mammalian disturbance. I mean, if you think these plants and mushrooms haven't co-evolved with mammals for the past, you know, millions of years, you're kind of missing the trick there. And so, that's interesting that you've run up against that. And I've heard that as well, that I'm used to that kind of conservation angle. But yeah, this idea that you're somehow tainting the pure act of foraging by in any way commercializing it. If we hold to that strict a belief structure, you know, it puts a lot of options outside of that commercial industrial system out the window in terms of survival.
Yeah. But you see, having said all this, right, I'm still involved in the commercial foraging thing, but I'm not very much. So basically my wife and a couple of other people just run that now.
Yeah.
And I mainly do the teaching. But it's been going for 18 years now. And I have to say that 18 years in, I am a lot less clear that it's all good. You know, what I mean is, so I've become quite disenfranchised with the restaurant industry, because, you know, I just thought that everyone was coming from the same place that I was. You know,
right?
That here we are, we're engaging with ingredients that are ancient. We're pulling things back to this kind of direct relationship with land and other species, you know. So the point of contact initially was, hey, chef, see this weird wild plant? Well, you can eat it. And chef goes, that's amazing. And he takes it and works it into his menu. And there we go. But after a while, we're kind of coming back again saying, hey, chef, you know, there's this thing called indigenous culture. And when we do this thing with the wild plant, we're actually reconnecting with our ancestors. And like, with change in the relationship that we have in a way that hey, you know, do you know these bioactive compounds in these plants are just incredible? And like, if you were to tell your customers and they're like, could I have 500 grams of wild garlic? And I'm going, what? I'm thinking, hey, hang on a minute. Like, we've started on this journey with these people that are super motivated to connect. But then when we get to the next bit of our journey, we look around and see no one's following, you know, from this crowd. And it took me so long to realize, you know, the constraints on a restaurant. You know, to some extent, I'm highly sympathetic. You know, you got to pay the rent, you've got to pay the staff, you've got to do all this. But I don't know. I just think largely the neoliberal capitalist industrial consumer culture has got the restaurant industry by the balls. And right. I didn't realize that, you know, because there's so many people making public statements or their PR, their kind of marketing strategy is so about kind of giving lip service to indigenous culture, to, you know, having a low carbon footprint, to zero waste or whatever. But when you get behind it and see that actually what's driving this is ambition and the lust for money, you know, sorry, chefs, but you know it's true. That's deeply disappointing, because I really thought that this was like the catalyst that was going to spark a revolution,
right,
with some of these high-end chefs that are engaging with foraging and so on. And after a while, you think, no, this is greenwash. You know, people are wearing these kind of things as a badge of honor to say, I'm connecting with land. You know, I'm building relationships with my suppliers. I'm, you know, all of this. I'm wanting to change the global food system. And you think, no, you want to get rich and famous. Actually, you are wanting to get rich and famous, and you're using the tool of rich and famousness in these days, which is PR. You know, this is, you know, you're gonna market yourself, and you're gonna develop this amazing capacity to seem to be.
Right. Well, and you could say, you know, if I'm completely honest with myself, I've been the victim of that, talking about having a show about connection with the land. But how deep does that really suffuse into my life? You know, I've got a day job, we have a house, you know, we're kind of stuck in that very same system that we hope that foraging kind of brings us out of, or maybe it transmutes or evolves that system to something that can be in more homeostasis with the natural environment, reorient value systems, all those good things that so many of us, including me on this show, promote as like foraging is a cipher or a keystone that will help unlock some of these other changes that if everyone does it, the culture suddenly turns around. But I guess, how do we pierce deeper? Or maybe for you in your journey, how did you pierce deeper? Maybe this has to do with you starting to really unpack traditional ecological knowledge, developing relationships with actual indigenous practice. I mean, what did that look like for you?
To be honest, I had a lot of Zoom calls last year and so on with a guy we had on our podcast called Mark Lewis, who's a Native American guy with a lot of heritage. And I don't know, there was just something about talking to him and other people that I've met, but when you're not, we got no roots, you know. So it's very hard to recreate a space that you'd stand in if you knew that your actual ancestors, in an unbroken line, have always connected with land, have always belonged in a particular place. So, you know, I think it starts with realizing that we are orphans and we are lost, you know, and you have to confront that. You know? And it is a place of profound grief and agony, really, because you just think, well, you know, how do I get from being just piece of flotsam and jotsam? You understand that term? Like just a piece of dust blowing in the wind, you know, with no place, no established roots with anything, anyone or anywhere. You know, actually, that's what we are when we're in this kind of white Western culture. Yeah. And you know, you can't go beyond, you can't do anything about that unless you confront the bitter loss of being a human being that's been born into that kind of context, you know. But then you see the earth is like a nursing mother that immediately is prepared, willing, and actively engaged in inviting us, you know, to draw us back in, you know. So I think, to me, that's the journey that I've been on. But I'm not here saying like, and I've arrived, and now I'm this really deeply rooted guy, you know. Can you just feel a vibe? It's just, you know, listen, this is you don't undo that degree of lostness and uprootedness, you know. But what you do is have to face it, you know. Just say, you know, we're so quickly going to reorientate to these devices that are going to, you know, make sure that I kind of develop my career path and I develop my public persona, and, you know, it's so easy to default to that. But we have to not do it, you know. And the fact that we're using these media of mass communication, that podcast, film, television, writing, anything like that, those devices are still there wanting to grab hold of you. And the problem is, if you allow that to happen, then people that are hungry for the good stuff will follow you down that dark alley. That's what's happening with these chefs, you know. Loads of young chefs who are now disciples of the wizards of seeming to be, you know. The ones that can best spin this web of illusion that they're really connected to land, they're really connected to this, and they're not. They're really connected to keeping this PR and publicity machine going. Whilst, yeah, working hard in the kitchen and so on, I couldn't do it. So, you know, all kind of credit to the work ethic and the fact that people work away and look after their team and so on. But it's not what it's pretending to be, you know. And that's because we're slap bang in the middle of a neoliberal culture that'll get you if you drop your guard for a minute. And not dropping your guard means that you have to check, where am I coming from, right? And it's as simple as this. You know, I've waffled on about this a lot on my own podcast, but are you engaging fundamentally on a basis of trust with everything that is, you know? Or are you engaging on a basis of control? I've got to make sure I'm looking after number one. I'm going to guarantee my path here. So I've got all this stuff in place, but make sure that if no other person helps me, I'll be all right. I'll have money and I'll have a reputation. So I'll still be able to, you know. Right. Whereas if you engage on the basis of trust, you, and again, I'm not sitting there going, see, look at me, I'm Mr. you know, it's not, but I'm at least beginning to turn in that direction, you know, because I can see that we're lost. And we'll get loster and loster and loster unless we reorient. You know, that's what's got us into this position. You know, white males basically have taken this to another level. But to me, the onset of agriculture was the first mistake. You know, rather than trusting that the land will sustain us, we developed this system that would guarantee the outcome there. But like that's upgrade, that's just ratcheted it up to just vastly beyond anything anyone could have imagined with the Industrial Revolution. Now we're gonna pin Mother Earth down with our foot on our neck and say you provide, and there's nothing you can do about it. You're gonna give us everything we want. We don't care what you think, and we don't care.
Almost even more concerning is then that eventually leads to, well, we'll re-engineer a better version of this. You know, we'll create new molecules. We'll overwrite organic chemistry, because you get on a very dangerous path when you don't realize that you're lost and you think you're going the right direction. I mean, just a really profound perspective you laid out. And really, it answered my question beautifully, is how do we kind of pierce and go deeper, you know, instead of just talking about it and it all looks great and we kind of have these whatever bumper sticker phrases, how do we go deeper? And I think a big part of that is admitting where we're at, admitting kind of where we are, how lost we are. And that leads to kind of the next big question. And before I move on, actually, I have to know, have you read the book Ishmael?
I think I've heard of this book. You have to email me
I'll email it over to you. It's about this man who meets a giant talking gorilla who essentially gives him a history lesson about how the origination of farming in Mesopotamia was the dewilding of humans. And suddenly we thought we were these soft, pink, fleshy beings that couldn't operate in the natural world and were separate from it. I just hear the concepts. Yeah, you just elucidated it, the concepts all in that book. But then, you know, the next question is, and again, a massive question, I'm laying at your feet, but is it possible to reinstantiate it? I mean, as lost kind of orphans who are trying to figure it out, is it possible to kind of, with the appropriate deference and reverence, refer back to living indigenous cultures, pull concepts that we feel are sorely lacking and we understand have to reorient us? And then can we pass that down to our kids? I mean, is it possible to reinstantiate this even though we are lost?
We have to. There's no other option.
And I guess that's part of what you're doing with education at this point. It sounds like your teaching has evolved to try to set some kind of cultural norm, because it's hard to have cultural norms and appreciation when the background for culture is absent.
Well, no, exactly. And just to get people working with these plants, I mean, you know, there's some really hopeful things, I think. Well, the way I end up expressing it is, you know, that what we've done is we've been snipping away at the threads, you know, of the fabric of life that sustains us. That's what we've been doing, you know, for thousands of years, but especially since the Industrial Revolution. And now it's just increasing at an exponential pace. Snip, 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 snip. And so, you know, that's why we're naked. That's why we're empty. That's why we're cut adrift, you know. But like, for people to start building culture with around one plant at a time, that is stitching and weaving these threads back together, reestablishing this fabric. And it's taken me a long time to realize, especially because I'm like most foragers, right? I've done this as a personal, very almost private, individualistic, not individualistic, but individual obsession, you know. And a lot of us are like that, you know. We've irritated our spouses or our parents or whoever it is, like, for crying out loud, can't you just give it a break? And so on. Most of us are like that. And yet now, what I've kind of had, you know, as a dawning perspective, is that, okay, we take that, but now it's all about collective activities, you know, people gathering stuff together, people processing stuff together, people cooking stuff together and developing recipes. And well, one collective thing that I'm really happy about is, so there's a plant called rosebay willowherb, I'm sure you know it, it's also known as fireweed. When I wrote the book, I researched all the plants as best I could. Now, I could have overlooked something, but, you know, I went to a lot of libraries and I didn't find anything about fireweed being used for tea. But it's a Japanese tea that's been used for a long time, and probably elsewhere. And then the health benefits, which I did know about, is that it prevents and treats prostate cancer. So one that guys should be just drinking every day. But years ago, you know, I thought, well, and I remember cooking it for my dad and he liked it. But I thought, well, how could you actually get that in your life as something that you ingest every day? So the missing piece was you can make a tea out of it. Well, somebody came across the technique for this Japanese tea, somebody in the foraging community, I forget who it was, and they started sharing it. And then all of a sudden, everyone makes rosebay willowherb tea now. But this is just the foraging community, right?
Yeah.
But I'm talking about it as much as I can. And there's parts of the north of England and Scotland where rosemary willow herb is just everywhere. So I can't do the calculations. Maybe there's not enough rosemary willow herb for every guy in England, in the British Isles to drink it every day. But if not, we could encourage it a bit. But I don't know. To me, that's a perfect example. It's a very recent example, and it went viral because of the internet. So that's the thing that we've got to realize that we've got these spaces that we're in. I'm sure you do realize, but like everything we're doing out that's getting out to an audience and just listening to chats like this while they're driving or washing up or whatever it is. It's just seeding these other perspectives and this actually very useful knowledge that people can pick up and then use and disseminate. So, you know, we are doing the work. It's just all I'm saying is, I know you're right with me, but like, you know, we just got to watch out for those snares because it detracts from the work. You know, like we're creating linkages. We do mass media stuff. I've had two amazing people just beat a path to my door in the last year. Just from having heard a podcast that I've done and really key people, you know, that are making a difference to my life and the work I'm trying to do. And you just, and like synchronicity around both of those people, left, right, and center. But the point of contact was that they heard a podcast. So, you know, we are doing this work. I don't want to just kind of depress you by that.
It's happening. Yeah.
But, you know, we're finding our way back, you know, and the fact that we can make these connections, you know, across oceans and so on, to have these conversations and then people being able to join the conversations as if everybody that's listening to this podcast now, right, is sitting around a fire that we've made this evening and we're passing around something nice to eat and drink, maybe somebody will get their guitar out later. You know, it's almost as good as that. And that's the idiom that we have with podcasts. I think it is wonderful. It's very non-hierarchical. It's very kind of wear your heart on your sleeve. As I was saying to you before we started the podcast, I don't care about making mistakes or saying the wrong thing and all that because you know, we want to represent, to me, this medium is one where we can be as close to everybody just hanging out and being themselves and saying what they do around a community fire or something. So I'm supremely hopeful, in spite of this depressing piece that I'm bringing about the lostness. I'm supremely hopeful because life is more powerful than these anti-life forces that we're up against. It is.
Yeah.
It's going to come back, you know. The biosphere, our DNA, you know, the love that comes between people when they drop their guard, you know, these things are unstoppable. They're absolutely unstoppable. So, you know, we just got to keep faith with it. But, you know, we do have to realize what a mess we're in.
That's step one, but I like that profound message of hope and that everybody, you know, it kind of puts winds in your sails when you know that you're sharing this information, whatever your audience is, what you never know. That's why I always tell people, you never know who you're going to connect with, who that message reaches, how that affects someone else. So that's a huge part of it. And I think you've just established a new metric by which to judge podcasts. It doesn't feel like I'm around a fire. Are we playing guitar? Are we having fun eating and drinking? I absolutely love that concept. And just to get in a little bit more knowledge here, I am supremely curious now about your kind of 10 common plants. If we were on a vicarious class with Miles Irving, what are those 10 common plants that maybe listeners, wherever they are, could potentially have in their yards? We're talking kind of in the Western world, UK, US, Canada, that kind of thing. What are those 10 common plants for you that you teach in your classes?
Well, I think if we're going for a universal thing, I should just plug somebody else's book and apologies to the particular somebody else. I can remember the name of the book and not your name, but the book's called The Wild Wisdom of Weeds, and it's about I think there's 13 plants in that book. But what she's attempted to do is write a book that's about the plants that are everywhere.
But the Wild Wisdom of Weeds.
Yeah. So to check that book out if you're wanting to have this. And that's something that, you know, the beautiful thing with that is potentially, you know, foragers around the world can connect around those 13 plants. There's things like chickweed, plantain, wild mustard, oxalis. I forget what they all are off the top of my head, dock. But anyway, so some of those plants would be mine. But I think for a US audience, cow parsnip is what you call it. We call it hogweed. That'll be one of my 10. It's just such a useful plant. And I make salads and I cook down the leaf stalks as a crunchy vegetable. As a soft, sticky vegetable, if you cook it slowly, it can go into a braise or a casserole. I love hogweed. We do so much with it. And then the seeds are a spice, which is popular all across the Middle East. In Syria, they call it golpa. So hogweed, definitely. Nettles, they're way up the top of the list. Okay, so I've got to use one of my favorite gags here. So when I'm on the walks, I always say to people, look, if you're worried about poisoning yourself, you need a plant that you can be sure about its identity. You've got to start with nettles. This is the only wild edible plant that I know of that you can reliably identify in the dark.
It's true.
But it's true. It's true. Nothing stings you like a nettle. So if you're worried about plant ID, start with nettles. Get really confident around nettles. And then secondly, the thing with nettles is that they're full of free glutamate. So that means they've got half of the umami equation. The other half is a bit of a mouthful. It's a thing called a ribonucleotide, but you'll find that in mushrooms and seaweed and cheese. And you know, meats have both glutamate and ribonucleotides. But I do these things with nettles where I say, we're going to do nettles and eggs to get the ribonucleotides with the glutamate in the nettles, or nettles and mushrooms. And you're going to see how having two halves of the umami equation, it's like 2 add 2 equals 9. You know, it's
that's huge. Yeah.
So then nettles, all of a sudden, they're not just a green. They're great as a green. Greens are great. I like greens. But they're a source of this delicious, savory umami thing. So all of a sudden, they're a cooking ingredient that you can craft things with and get great flavors, especially if you're vegan and you're trying to get back that umami slice of your flavor experience, which I think is a very important point, actually. I was talking to somebody about this today. You know, we've got to make sure that when we're asking people to go plant-based, which I can't say I'm particularly asking that because I eat meat myself, but I'm certainly trying to cut down my meat consumption. So, you know, we mustn't be trying to get people to violate their own biology. You know, we crave umami. We crave those savory things. And that's because, A, we grew up with it.
Right.
And when we're changing diets, we've got to not do this kind of violence to ourselves. Like, let's take the familiarity with us, you know. Let's just try and recraft it. Okay, we want to cut out this food stuff. You know, we feel weird enough as it is. Let's not make ourselves feel even more weird by only eating foods that have nothing to do with the foods we grew up with, because that's part of our familiarity and well-being.
Well, and as a vegan, that little piece about nettles, hugely inspiring. We're going to start putting nettles in everything.
Yeah, well, nettles, mushrooms, and seaweed, those are your keys. Those are your plant-based keys for umami. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm trying to come up with these 10 plants.
We don't have to do all 10 necessarily, but I just wanted to give some examples for people.
See, I like to talk about one, so you don't dare get me to do the 10 now. I can understand.
Well, I think it's good. It's just a little piece, and people can go, obviously, sign up for your courses, learn more information. But something I wanted to mention, too, that seems so central, and that actually is one of the biggest takeaways that I kind of glossed over, is this concept of community. And I'm always envious when I see people out as a family. You know, where I am in Northern California, there's a huge Italian and Eastern European influence in this area. It's actually one of the reasons why California state parks do have legal mushroom picking, is those cultural groups lobbied the Forest Service and the state government, said this is culturally significant. We go out and do this together. Everyone in California, you can thank a lot of those communities, those mushroom-loving European communities, for the reason we can pick mushrooms in state parks legally. But this idea of community, and that actually is a huge piece that I know, like you said, as myself, I'm a very solitary forager. I like to be alone out in the woods. I don't even like to see anyone. If I do, I kind of hide. Maybe not always, but it's that kind of idea. But I love that idea. If you can bring people in and do this process together, process the food together, that's an even more potent way to instill some of this change in relationships. So I wanted to make sure I brought that up too. That seems central to what you're talking about.
Well, it's great. All I can say is I wish I was doing more of it. But
well, in this day and age, you know, with everything going on, restrictions and everything else, that's tough. But
we had just started an acorn project before the lockdown, and we're realizing we can start it again now, and I keep having scheduling problems. One of these people that approached me, having heard me talk about wanting to build community around wild food, just got in touch and said, I'll help you build community around wild food. So he's one of the people that come along for this acorn. So we started having acorn days. So we went picking acorns, then we kind of met and processed some acorns, and then we had a couple of chefs, and we were looking at like acorn miso and other different experiments. And then the lockdown really hit, so we haven't managed to recover that. Mind you, this guy has become an acorn ambassador. Like, he went to Greenbelt Festival and spent 2 weeks there. He had to buy his acorn flour from Greece because our processing thing stopped. which was a bit funny, but still, he had acorn flour, and he spent 2 weeks showing families how to make acorn sourdough bread. So, you know, he's been disseminating this little germ of cultural knowledge, which is hot off the press. Acorn right. sourdough bread. Who's heard of acorn sourdough bread? But, like, you know, brand new culture. But off the back of conversations we've been having with this guy I mentioned earlier, Mark Lewis, who was showing us his traditional techniques for working with acorns and so on. So it's just got that connection. Just wanted to do a lot more of that kind of stuff, really. But like people from the local football club, my little boy goes to a football club, and you know there's a guy from there who's definitely not a hippie, you know, like
pretty. But he's into it.
Yeah, but he came along with his kids, his wife and kids, and they're foraging for the acorns, and so you know it's like a nice little mix of people, but. You know, very small beginnings on that front, but that's really what we're wanting to do. I'm hoping to do a thing with the local village hall and have a regular kind of spot where people come to learn about foraging. You know, maybe we'll build community around that. But yeah, it's definitely the way forward.
Well, and I love that you're approaching centers of community that aren't limited to, you know, a hippie crowd. You're kind of approaching the village hall and approaching people because this is the domain of everybody. You know, as much as, you know, everyone can gatekeep, say, oh, you're not really into that. We need to welcome everyone in with open arms.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm talking about things I intend to do, and I'm slightly irritated to even, you know, like I'd much rather talk about what I am doing.
Sure.
It's just, I'm deeply conscious that, you know, the stuff that I am doing in terms of teaching mainly middle-class people with an ecological sensibility and a real interest in food. I mean, that's fantastic because they're super engaged. They come and you know you will have an impact, you know, but I'm sort of just looking over here at the other groups of people who maybe need it a lot more. They're probably, you know, in their communities there's a lot more kind of diet related health issues and so on, and probably much, you know, all sorts of other issues. So yeah, somehow or another we've got to start taking these messages to people who aren't already thinking this way, you know.
Well, and even just by sharing that, you're planting the seed in so many people who are wild food educators or enthusiasts. That's a good call to action that everybody can listen to and tap into, is how do we make this reach people who aren't already preaching? You know, how do we not preach to the choir, basically? And I think that's a challenge in whatever you're talking about, is how do you move beyond that immediately ripe and engaged audience to people that yeah. really need this information? And, you know, I think by putting it out there, you are definitely doing that work. And another, you know, massive piece, just for people that want to learn more about traditional ecological knowledge, I can tell you've been heavily influenced by people from living indigenous cultures. What would you recommend, maybe in terms of resources, maybe in terms of mindset and attitude, maybe even in terms of locality? Because that's one thing I've had past guests point out is, man, there are indigenous cultures to reconnect with if you're in the British Isles, and a lot of them have their own tenets of ecological knowledge for that area. That was just being a normal human before this weirdness happened. So what would be any, you know, recommendations or advice for people that want to engage more with that information?
There's so much literature out there, and memory is so sketchy for names. I remember book titles, but you'll know about this. Robin something or other, but Braiding Sweetgrass, you got to read that.
Yeah. Right?
And then you're in California, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the other one, Tending the Wild. Yeah, so that's a...
That's the one I was thinking of, and I was trying to remember the author's name too, and it's escaping me right this second.
Maybe you can get it on the show notes or something. Maybe if you yeah. Google Tending the Wild, you're going to get this. That's an amazing account of traditional land and wild resource management by indigenous people. Then the biggest estate on earth, that's Bill Gammage, I believe. That's about Australian indigenous land management. And it is incredible, the picture that it paints. Then there's another book more recently called Dark Emu, which I haven't been able to engage with it because it is so depressing, like the account. I've read the story before, but reading it from his side. But he's this guy, Bruce something or other, he goes into more detail than the greatest estate on earth. But basically the land management techniques that they had caused that land to flourish, and it was continent wide. You know, with their system of songlines, even though they had different languages, they would be able to, different tribes would have knowledge of land way beyond their own borders. And so the whole landscape was being managed on the same culture. You know, it's basically the same culture everywhere, even though there's huge regional variations. But there's never been a continent-wide culture. So that's why I think, you know, the tragedy of what happened in Australia is such a deep tragedy. These people were there for maybe as much as 70,000 years, but at least 50,000 years, building this culture, slowly developing how do we work with this land, these species, these plants, and so on. So I think, you know, we just, and then there's Nancy Turner's book, Ancient Wisdom, Ancient Something or Other. This is her like a magnum opus, it's a two-volume set, but it goes into so much depth of detail of what it was to be this culture, how they worked with different plants, how they organized themselves in this way. But I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure that Indigenous communities want thousands of us rocking up at their door going, excuse me, we're lost. Can you show us what to do?
We're a bunch of lost children. Help us.
So you came and destroyed our culture, and now you want. But you know, what do we do? What do we do? I think we need to talk amongst ourselves much more, probably. But you know, just the okay. So I wrote a very hopeful thing in the beginning of my book. You know, that we can mourn about the loss of our traditional ecological knowledge. Okay, and in the UK, yeah, we lost it. But the point is, it's like this pattern recognition thing. You know. The plants are still here. We're still here. Well, there is something that is utterly integral to our DNA and to our spirit, if you want to think about it like that. If you reestablish contacts, then this infrastructure of a woven fabric of culture and connection and emotional bonding and all of it, you know, from an individual and a collective perspective, you know, it cannot fail to reemerge. You know, what we just need to do is reestablish the contact. And I don't know of a better way to reestablish contact than finding and eating wild food. But the key point is start doing that together with other people. Yeah.
Well, just really well said and profound. And again, so much authenticity there. You know, as I asked that question, I know that you're someone who's figuring it out just like everyone else. I mean, you're very much on the journey. You're not at the finish line saying, here's how I became this amazing. You're saying, hey, I'm learning, I'm figuring it out, I'm lost too. All those resources I think you mentioned are amazing reading. I've kind of cracked the cover on at least two of those books, but haven't gotten all the way through. But yeah, deeply profound insights to be gained there, you know, and ideally we can pick up the pieces of the natural world, re-engage, become normal people again, re-engage and apply those pattern recognition and observation, and you know, reestablish or retap into what that framework of ecological knowledge has been. And beautifully, beautifully said. Well, I'm sure for people listening, they want to hear more, they want to see your courses, they want to listen to the podcast. Where can people find you and all your work?
Okay, so the best thing to do is world wild, not worldwide. worldwild.org.uk. And so the podcast is there. We actually haven't done a podcast for over a year now. I just reached a point where, anyway, I had a bit of a rethink, but we're about to restart.
Fantastic.
But there's a 50 episodes to trawl through in the meantime. So.
Plenty to keep you busy. And I mean, this is what we've been talking about, is grist to the mill. I mean, this is everything that you guys talk about in depth with so many different people. So I highly encourage people to go listen in to World Wild if you like this podcast. You know, and usually I'll wrap things up with three questions that I like to ask all of my guests. And now I feel remiss that I cut off your list of wild plants, because maybe that would be the most interesting thing to wrap up with. So maybe give us a mushroom you love and why, and maybe also a wild plant that you love and why, maybe from that list of 10. And just, yeah, a mushroom you love and why, and maybe a plant you love and why.
Okay. Well, I love porcini. And
it's not to love, yeah.
I actually did a whole podcast that's based around a question. I was with a friend doing a podcast, but we decided to do it in the woods, and we just hit the jackpot with the porcini season. You know, they were everywhere. And in the end, we picked so many, and we said, we probably better stop doing this and do that podcast now. So it was nearly dark before we started talking and recording. But I said to him, but we were sitting there with this great big pile of porcini, and I said, Matthew, why do mushrooms make me so happy? So you can see that that podcast gets a lot of hit from the psilocybin crowd and so on, but it's nothing to do with that. It was that we were sitting there looking at this pile of porcini. I said, why do mushrooms make me so happy? And he said, I can tell you why that mushroom makes you so happy. It's got the neurotransmitter GABA in it. That's the thing that shuts your kind of fear shock reaction in your amygdala in your brain. Your amygdala gets basted in GABA, and it will happen if somebody shows empathy to you, for example. You will then calm down. GABA will just go like that. Well, porcini has GABA in it, so Matthew was able to answer that question.
Okay. So we have a definitive answer to why mushrooms make us so happy. In some cases, there are literal chemicals that are bathing our amygdala.
I didn't expect that answer. It was a great answer. And then plant-wise, well, I've already talked about hogweed, which is probably the plant I eat most of. But I think my favorite plant is wild celery. It's not a particularly widespread plant, but I think it sums it up. So wild celery is intensely flavorful. And then you have this cultivated version, which a friend of mine once pointed out, people who cultivate celery have found an amazing new way to market water. You plant a cultivated celery seed and it sucks loads of water up, and you have this thing that doesn't really taste of anything with loads of water.
Right.
It's expensive water, yeah. So wild celery sums it all up, that like, what did we think we were doing when we cultivated things? I know that's a bit simplistic, and there are some results I'm quite pleased with in the front of cultivation, like a cultivated pear. If you've ever eaten a wild pear, you just think, man, I'm not going to eat one of those again. It's very astringent, very sour, and very hard. So, you know, I'm not. But wild celery does show, just prove the lie of the idea that, you know, everything needs cultivating to make it better, because wild celery is definitely better.
That's a very good point. Is sometimes cultivation and that human selection gives us something that's more palatable to humans over time. Pears and also apples, of course, being that classic example where, you know, apples have that variation where they can be different every single time, even if it's coming from a seed of an apple you like, which is mind-blowing. But yes, that idea that not everything cultivated is going to taste better. And for many foragers, luckily, we've kind of gotten the gist of that and gotten that understanding. Well, then, what is this relationship specifically with fungi given to you? Because you can tell you've got a relationship with nature. I mean, flora, fauna, plants, but then fungi in particular, how do they fit in there? What has that brought to your life?
Well, I've got to say that you know, mushrooms were definitely my first love, and foraging-wise, and they've still got that ultimate place in my heart for foraging, yeah. They're just so elusive. They're kind of wilder than the plants. The plants are, in a sense, quite tame, because you go back and there they are, you know. Go back at the right time of year, there's the wild garlic, there's the nettles, you know. Mushrooms, they're totally wild. They'll come and they'll go. And so when you find them again, you think, oh, there you are. Even though you've gone back to the same place, like you can go back to the same place for 5 years sometimes and the trumpets haven't come up, and then there they are again. So they've got that elusive, magical quality to them that keeps your interest, I think. Yeah, they say absence makes the heart go fonder. So there's nothing that beats picking mushrooms. I've picked mushrooms, you know, till 2 a.m. sometimes when we found a big yield and we're traveling, you know. So if I don't pick them now, we're not going to have them. So,
well, this, I would guess, I mean, the feeling you had when you were 6 years old out with your grandfather, probably not that much different from today.
Oh, it's not. You're just like a little kid when you're foraging. Yeah. That joy of discovery, that joy of, you know, the harvest, and there's your real dopamine hit. You know, there's a whole other topic we could have got into, but like these days, you know, everyone's wanting that thrill of the chase and the satisfaction of, you know, getting something you desire. You know, well, mushrooms, it balances it out, because you desire them all the time. And then once a year, or for some species, once every 5 years, you get your dopamine hit. That's the way it should be.
Yeah, maybe it'll help us break our addiction to Instagram and all these apps. You know, forget electronic hearts. Give me a mushroom. That's really going to give me the dopamine hit.
That's what I feel. I just feel that when I find a sap, I can say that. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then another big, broad question, and we've really talked about a lot of, you know, why foraging gives hope and some of these, really, I mean, you've given us some tangible things that can help us kind of reorient But maybe if there's anything mushroom or fungi specific that as the Western world gets more acclimated and familiarized with these organisms as food, but also as, you know, different technologies and things, how do you hope that changes the world for the better? Maybe in the coming decades, and that could be, oh, we all live in mushroom houses, or maybe we're just more ecologically mindful. But how do you hope that changes things?
Well, I don't know. I mean, just a very practical thing, like the medicinal mushrooms thing is going to save a lot of people's lives. I mean, it's clear, you know. Mm. What mushrooms do for your immune system and against cancer and whatnot. And it's just heartbreaking to know that people are dying today, that in 10 years' time, they won't die because they'll have turkey tail for breast cancer or chaga for other cancers and things like that. I just think, well, you know, we've got to get this out there. We've got to really just get the hang of rewilding forests with medicinal mushrooms and all of this kind of thing. But I just think the metaphor of mycelium, that this is like a body that's made up of what starts out as individual organisms. So each spore in the ground grows out and becomes a hyphae, which then fuses with compatible hyphae, and you end up with this amazing mycelial mat, which is just an unbelievable metaphor for community, I think. So, you know, we need to fuse with the compatible hyphae, like we've been talking about, across the internet, across the world, and just let's get this kind of global tribe thing happening of people of goodwill that love the land and just don't want to fuck it up anymore. So.
That's one of the most exciting things for me is how fungi change those narratives around human culture. We've always based it on natural systems, you know, in terms of identifying how we relate to each other. We kind of relate it to animals and fungi challenge that. So I love that new kind of narrative is let's all form a mycelial mat. Forget hierarchy. Let's form a mycelial mat. Well, that's fantastic. Miles, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, being so open, authentic, sharing so much practical solutions, foraging knowledge. It was really a pleasure getting to speak with you. So thank you for joining us on the Mushroom Hour.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah. Thanks for having me.